This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to Heritage Radio. This is The Line. Joining me today is Chef Laurent Tarandel. He was born in France and he started cooking at a very young age. He joined a four-year program at Chef, I apologize for my French. It's probably not going to be correct. Hopefully you can correct me during the course of the show. So you joined a four-year program at St. Vincent École de Cuisine, and then you earned an aptitude professionnelle de cuisinier. And then after graduating from that program, you worked as chef to the admiral in the French Navy. In the years that followed, Chef worked under such notable chefs as Bruno Tisson, Jacques Maximin at Restaurant Le Lion in France, and he also worked at the Restaurant Mercury in the Hotel Intercontinental in Moscow. Chef Tarandel was named Bon Appetit magazine's Restaurateur of the Year in 2007. He's published three cookbooks. He currently oversees or has consulted on over 15 restaurants and projects around the world that now have locations in Miami, Hong Kong, San Juan, and even Kazakhstan. Chef, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
So I want to start at the beginning. So how old were you when you began to sort of pursue a career in cooking? Tell us a little bit about the four-year program that you enrolled in, and what was that like in France at that time?
Training, cooking school. You know, I was 13. I was actually 12 and a half. We had this school where I lived in France, and it was called, you know, three option. And my dad gave me the three option of, leaving general school and then getting to a boarding school where I was going to study a job. So the option was to be a chef. And then the other one was to be a tailor, and the other one was to be an office manager, I remember.
So it was a trade school, essentially,
trade
right?
School,
so you're
yeah.
just, you
right.
started at a very young age, and you're pursuing the job that you have to do that job, basically,
right.
once
right.
you finish.
Right.
And so you're 12 and a half, you're 13 years old, and you start cooking. How rigorous of a program is it? Are we talking like white chef coats and you're learning knife skills? Are you in a classroom? Are you in a kitchen? What exactly did it consist of?
Yeah, it is. It is completely a full training, but 4 days a week of cooking, you know, about 4 hours a day, and the rest are general general school, you know, mm-hmm. General classes. And then, white chef, jacket, knives, I mean, you know, and I mean, the good part of it, it's you're young, so you are willing to learn, and then you're learning from the beginning. You're learning the base of cooking, you know, how to chop, how to handle a knife, how to place a cutting board, how to light a stove, how to clean a pot. You're learning what's most of people actually do not know now.
Yeah, you start at the fundamentals, at
yeah.
the base of doing the things that perhaps now are overlooked and are taken for granted, that someone might come into your kitchen or someone else's kitchen and you think, well, they probably know how to fold towels and set up a station and work cleanly, but perhaps maybe they don't. So at that time, were you thinking, oh, I've made this decision because I was presented with three options and I chose one, or Yes. Did you feel like, so you didn't really know, oh, I'm going to be a chef and this is going to be everything that I'm going to do for the rest of my life?
I mean, how do you know at 12 years old, you know, or 13 years old? I mean, you don't have a full idea of what you want to do for the rest of your life. So I knew cooking was a passion somehow. It was a family thing. You know, my grandparents were cooking, my dad, my mom, everybody was cooking. We lived in the house with a garden. So, you know, it was sort of like the natural thing for me. I knew already more than anyone else at school.
What did your parents do? Where did you grow up? And what sort of careers or life did you have growing up outside of...
We grew up in a small town in France, in the center of France. And then my parents were... you know, living in a house with my parents, and we had a garden in the back, and then we'll cook every day different stuff. And, you know, that was the...
Did your father have a specific job, or was he a farmer?
No, he was... how do I explain that? He was a salesman, mm-hmm. you know. He sells toys and bicycle, you know.
And... In France, when you were growing up, I mean, now chef is it's a revered profession. Was it considered more of a trade, like a workman's job, or did it have a sort of power and an elegance to it that it does have today?
It always did.
It was considered sort of a dignified profession.
Yeah, because we have, you know, all those Michelin star rated chefs. And
do you have any experiences of being a kid and going to either a local restaurant or something maybe very fancy in Paris that sticks out in your mind of a meal, or perhaps a restaurant that you visited that really touched you?
Yes, for sure. My parents were friends with this famous chef named Roger Verger in the south of France, and then we used to go over there. My parents were doing all those big restaurants sometime on weekends, and they will take me over so I could see and learn and maybe spend some time and visit the kitchen, you know. And at my young age, my dad was a friend with the local chef who owned the local one Michelin star restaurant. And they actually, I was spending time in the kitchen at 12, 13 years old.
And what were they letting you do, if anything?
I know you're going to ask this question. I was getting the lemon.
Lemon wedges.
Lemon, no, we call it lemon dandelion. It means like you do like the teeth of the wolf inside.
The what? The teeth of the wolf,
yeah. Mm. So.
Oh, it's sort of like the jagged when it fits together in two pieces.
Exactly.
And what was that for, like put on the plate as presentation on
seafood,
the side?
Seafood, you know, and stuff like that. So I was doing that and watching the rest of it. I was doing the butter dishes and... little thing, you know.
But that's cool because they were giving you maybe a small task, but there's knife skill involved, and they're basically saying, you know, do this off to the side, but if you get really good at it and you show that you can do it for hours and hours on end, then all right, maybe you can move on to another task. When you went into the program and then you're finishing up that program, how did you get... Did you get placed with the French Navy? Did you apply for that job? How did you end up?
It was not an option. You had to go to the Army or the Navy.
Okay.
So at 17, I went to the Navy for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I got picked up, you know, with your knife skill and what you can cook, I got picked up to be the chef for a bunch of admiral. In the south of France.
So where were you stationed exactly?
I was stationed in Toulon in the south of France.
And did you cook on a boat or were you on the land?
No, I was on land.
And how were they as customers or, you know, how did they treat you?
No, it was good. It was a good experience. We were about, I think, 15 of us on the land. It was a small hotel. We call it Hotel Particulier. And then it's a small hotel, you know, and it was an interesting journey, you know, to do the menus with them and you know, it was interesting, but we didn't really experience the Navy like, you know, we never hold a gun, or it was not this kind of
you Navy. Were cooks. You yeah, were just, it just chef, so happened yeah. that you were a chef right. in the Navy. You right. didn't really see any action. Right. When an admiral says, "I want this for dinner," was it ever hard to acquire ingredients? Like, did they make sort of outlandish demands, or were they eating sort of in the style of everyone else? Like, were their dinners really fancy, or were they eating sort of in the Navy?
They'll have fancy dinner sometimes. They'll invite people, political people. And then most of the time they were eating regular food, like you find at home.
Which is what? I mean, what were you usually cooking for them?
You'll have classical roulé à la russe, ham with Macedoine vegetables, tomato salad, you know. I mean, pretty basic food, you know.
Sure, but I mean, I'm thinking right now of like what a military ration would be for a normal soldier, and it's usually not that. But
no.
But so you're stationed there, and how long did you hold that position for?
2 years.
And so when you left the Navy, did you have any sort of idea of where you wanted to head? Did you have a restaurant in mind, or a chef that you were saying, "I would love to go work for them"?
I had no. You see, I don't even sure I wanted to continue about cooking. Uh-huh. This is where we were at this time, and then I met this guy who was sharing the same room as me, and he says, "Look, before coming to the Navy, I was in London. If you're interested, maybe you can come." I'm like, "You know, I don't speak English well, you know." And he goes, "Well, why don't we take a weekend and go visit London for a weekend, and I can introduce you, and you can see, you can meet people, you can see if you like the city." And then I loved it, and then I moved to London.
And you ended up at a gentleman's club.
Right.
Called Booties.
Boodles.
Boodles.
Yeah. The jean.
Tell me about that. Was it a... What does that mean, gentlemen's club? Was it a men-only place that you went and got a meal? Was it a sort of like a burlesque club? What happened there?
No, it's it's by members only, and mm-hmm. then it's a gentlemen's club, very British-oriented club where men get together, dressed up, smoking cigar, eating a bite, drinking port. You know, it's very... serious club. You know, you have to be sponsored by other members, and Prince Charles was the actual leader of the club. So it was a pretty serious thing. We accommodate a lot of personality, London aristocracy.
And so at that point you're really kind of you're cooking for like the creme de la creme, the top of the London elite. Were you using? Was it a French technique? Was it in the menu design and in the restaurant, or were you making more British style cuisine for them?
It was a combination of some British food, very classic British food, and also a combination of classic French. Based on the Escoffier cooking culinary.
And what's that? Can you describe
the Escoffier? The Escoffier is basically a Bible created by a chef named Escoffier in early 1900, where we all refer until this day about some classic recipes of the basic.
And that's where you can find the mother sauces and
right.
things of that nature.
Stock, classic sauces, preparation.
So really, the building blocks of a dish come from the specifics of Escoffier.
Right. Right. So the interesting part of it was really for me to stay and stick up to the this club and learn the basic. And I found it. British cooking, very interesting, actually, because it was actually very well made, and it tasted amazing, I have to say. strangely enough, you know, people think the British cooking is not very interesting. So I think it's pretty interesting when he's well made.
It has a bad reputation.
I know.
Still to this day, unfortunately. Why do you think that is? That
I think most of the British cooking is not well made. But I think when it's well made, I think it's some cool stuff, actually.
What's a very traditional British dish that you would have served then that would have been on the menu at the Gentleman's Club?
Shepherd's pie, mm-hmm. steak and kidney pie, Christmas pudding. I mean, it was a little bit of from everywhere in England, and some of them were very interesting. But it was very well managed as a French brigade inside the kitchen. You know, we had the first commis, second commis, chef de partie, demi chef de partie, you know, the sous chef, executive sous chef. I mean, it was a big brigade, you know.
And so the hierarchy, that structure, that's something that you must have been very familiar with coming from France and being classically trained. Were there people in the kitchen? Did you have a sort of an international staff at that point in the kitchen, or was it mostly French chefs that had come over to London?
No, I was the only French actually in the brigade. Most of them were Scottish, a couple of Irish, most of British.
How was your adjustment to living in London? It's not terribly far.
Rough. Rough.
Why? Was it because of the language? Like,
yes.
What were the things that made London difficult for you?
I mean, challenging by the language for sure, you know, and you know, I lived with two Scottish guys. We shared a house in Greenwich, and understand their accent, and it was, and at work it was really challenging because I didn't speak a word of English, so I really had to learn.
I feel like even if you can speak perfect English, two Scotsmen together is going
Rough.
To be difficult. There's going to be a lot of fast talking that's going to go over your head.
Right.
Did you find that from a cultural perspective that living in London was very different from where you had come from in France? Like, were you mostly in the kitchen, or when you had free time, was there a culture shock at all by being in London?
Yeah, sure. I mean, definitely. I mean, I only lived in my little village in France, and then going to London was like reaching the big city, and you know how, you know what, it's completely different. You know,
was it common at that time for people that had been classically trained in France in French technique and to then go abroad? Was that always happening, or were you kind of an outlier for you to leave France and not take a position at a, you know, one or two Michelin or three Michelin star restaurant in France right away? Was that considered out of the norm?
Yes. You know, culinary wise, I don't think I had the level of going to a three Michelin star. I think I needed to understand and study something else before. And I did that later, as a matter of fact. But yes, it was kind of like a little bit strange, you know.
Of the many places that you've worked, you've worked in France and Manhattan and Moscow and in London. Is there one specific restaurant or a chef that you feel that you learned the most from, or that helped you grow, that shaped you the most over a period of time?
I think all of them matters in a different way. I don't think there is one particular one. They were the rough, the rock and roll people. They were the guy who were classic, who were very intense. They were, you know, I think they taught me different things.
Now that you have for so many years been in charge of many restaurants, how do you think all the places that you went and worked informed your leadership style and the way you run a kitchen? Sometimes these days people can inherit kitchens quite quickly. It doesn't take as long maybe to rise to the position of chef de cuisine or executive chef as it used to. You worked for a very, very long time in many different places. How did that impact the way that you run your kitchens?
I think I adjust myself for what's going on now, you know. I mean, I think there's different talent, there is different style, different kind of chefs those days. You know, some people who I work with, they don't even know the knowledge of a classic cuisine, you know, and I'm not sure you need that anymore, actually. Hmm. I mean, of course, it's a controversy. I mean, you will have probably a chef who is standing next to me right now who will scream at me. But, you know, I find really interesting about some of the chefs who do not have an amazing experience, but who have an amazing palate and who come up with some amazing dishes, you know, being non-traditional and being creative. I'm not sure everything works when it's put on the plate, but I tasted some amazing dishes done by people who were not trying at all.
There can be sort of a freedom to not being classically trained that allows you to extend beyond the realm of what should or could be put on the plate, and sometimes it can hit and other times it can definitely miss. In your experience with sort of the new style of cook, where, you know, a lot of people are looking to rise quite quickly and perhaps not putting in the work that used to happen, do you encounter a lot of people in your restaurants that do you ever just sort of shake your head and say, like, that person, they don't have what it takes? Do you see a lot of people that these days don't have the sort of drive and passion that you would have seen 15 or 20 years ago? Or do you think it's similar or different as it was 15 or 20 years ago?
I think it's different, but equally interesting by cooks learning in a different way. I don't know. I think, like I said to you before, you know, I test some stuff sometimes, and I'm like, I will never have the idea of mixing it together, okay? And something bright comes out, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing, you know?
We're here with Chef Laurent Tarondel. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back here on the line.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I am joined by Chef Laurent Tarondel, a classically trained French chef who was in 2007 named Restaurateur of the Year by Bon Appetit magazine. He has many projects that he's worked on over the years, and I'm just going to rattle off a couple because there are so many, and we won't have time to cover them all, but there's LT Steak and Seafood in Miami. There's The Vine in New York City. There's LT Bar and Grill in Kazakhstan. There's LT Burger in Sag Harbor. There's Brasserie Ruhlmann in New York City. You're opening up another restaurant in Miami very soon. Is it called Poetti?
No, we changed the name.
Oh, what is it called?
It's called The Halle.
The Halle?
Yeah.
Cool. So really almost more projects than I can even list and wrap my head around. As a very, very young chef, entrepreneur. I have one very, very small restaurant with 10 seats that I just started. I'm going to ask you a question that's...
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's going to sound very open-ended, but how? Just how do you do it? How do you have so many projects in the works, and how have you been so successful building such a large group of restaurant projects that are both casual and high end?
Right. Well, first of all, I work a lot. I work constantly. Even if I'm not at work, I think about work, and my brain's still on it, even on my time off, of course. But I always have this desire of coming up with different concepts. So it could be a fine dining. It could be, I'm always interested about doing something new. We went through the burger joint. We went to the French brasserie. I did some sushi bar. We did a lot of steakhouse. I think maybe 20 steakhouse. High-end seafood restaurant, casual fish shack, Italian now, pizzeria.
Yeah, I mean, you're sort of covering all the cuisines possible. Right. Was it the partnership that kind of fueled things forward, and you said, I've got an idea, and then a team took that concept with your menu and pushed it forward? I know that a lot of these have spawned multiple units. They're sort of, call them a mid-sized chain, essentially, at this point. How did that come to be? Did someone approach you and say, we'd love to do a steakhouse with you, a burger joint? Did you find partners and to raise capital? Like, how exactly did it come to be?
It was different stage in my career. I had business partner, which I left years ago. And then now the structure of my business are completely different. Some of them are I own. Some of them I own with different partner. Some of them they are management deal. Some of them are licensing deal. And some of them are consulting. So in every case, it's a different structure of business.
So you listed a couple things there, and I'm hoping that we can just get a little bit of clarification. So what is the difference between a licensing and management?
Management, you manage the operation, mm-hmm. From the accounting to the waiter, to the staff, to the PR, to anything. Licensing, you're licensing your name, meaning you have a little control on it, but it depends how you negotiate. You could have a larger control over your name, or you can let it loose.
How does it feel to be a chef that has opened his own restaurants multiple times, and then to do consulting or to do a licensing and see things that represent you, but that you don't have full control over? Was that a difficult decision the first time you did it, to sort of relinquish the control, or...
You know, it's all related to food. So for me, I look at it as the quality of food is coming out, okay? Either it's my own restaurant or licensing or management deal, it still matters the quality of the food. So in either way, it's difficult, So this is the way I look at it.
Do you have corporate chefs or a traveling chef de cuisine or executive chef that comes with you to check on quality control and things of that nature?
Yes, I do. I have a corporate chef who's very good, who's been with me for a couple of years now. And then sometimes we travel together, sometimes he travels alone, or I travel alone.
It does seem kind of mind-boggling to just have, between all these places, it's several hundred people when you look at front of house, back of house, PR, right. HR, all these things. Did it happen in a way that you've been able to kind of grow accustomed to the size of the operation that you are, or does it surprise you at the size of your operation still?
No, I think, project come and go. Some of the restaurants I have, they've been open for 15 years. Some of them are just open, So I don't, I don't think about that. I think about, most important for me is really to open restaurant I want to open and my passion is inside. If it's a restaurant just to do a restaurant, I'm not excited about it. I'm not going to do it. You know, I have a lot of project offer and I turn down a lot of things because it's not what I want to do, you know.
So where do you call home? Where's your home base?
New York. Mm-hmm. I live in New York. Yeah.
And how often would you say that you're on the road? Like you've got a spot in Kazakhstan that you worked on. You've got spots in Miami. Do you go weeks at a time where you're on planes and traveling around?
It depends where it is. I actually just came back from Kazakhstan. We stayed a week. Mm-hmm. When I go to Asia, also in Hong Kong, I stay a week. When I go in the United States, I stay 3 days. You know, it depends where the location of the restaurant is and what is the problem. Because I always go when there's a problem, you know.
Okay, so awesome. Tell me specifically about a problem that you flew to Hong Kong or Kazakhstan for. And what does that look like when you show up and they say, Chef is here. Right. Chef has arrived from New York City. Like, right. You know.
I mean, look, it's always you know, a management issue. And I think what we do, the real issue are the staffing. It doesn't matter where you are, in the United States or in Asia. Mm-hmm. In Asia, a little bit less because the labor is a good labor and they work hard, you know. So it depends where I go. You know, situation is different all the time.
And when you show up there at your various locations, to you, is there a separation between chef and business person, or is it the same role within you?
I don't know. I never thought about making a difference. I'm not too sure. I mean, business is business, you know. I guess it's a difference. Yeah.
I ask because, you know, there are people that have a mind for cooking and leading a kitchen, and there are people that have a mind for business and expansion and right. Understanding licensing deals and management deals. It seems like you've been able to master both worlds. How have you gone about, you know, retaining your passion for the food, but also realizing that there's so many, I mean, you must go days without, unfortunately, cooking, right? There's a lot of business that has to happen and meetings and things of that nature that kind of pull you away, or is it not like that really?
No, it's not really like that. No, I try to schedule myself where I do meetings in the morning or I do meetings in the afternoon, and I try to spend lunch and dinner in some of my restaurants doing pure service and development with my corporate chef or the chef de cuisine for new dishes, new menus, you know.
Is there ever like a favorite or like a, you know, like a child that you're really focusing on? Like, do you sometimes spend a couple weeks straight in one of your New York restaurants because you're having the best time and like it feels fresh to you? Like when you open a new spot, do you go for the first 2 months that it's open and
for sure.
You spend a lot of time there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, my base restaurant right now, it's L'Amico in New York, this Italian restaurant. Well, we do both restaurants, actually. We do the Vine and L'Amico. So that's where I spend the most time right now. It's also something new about the Italian food I have in me and kind of like interesting and very enjoyable to do.
Is the act of service a thrill to you? Do you like the tickets coming in and the sort of the hustle bustle of the kitchen, or do you prefer sort of pre-service, the prep and the organization? Is there one thing that you enjoy doing more as a chef?
I like the service. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the adrenaline coming out, you know?
Yeah.
And then, I like to see who's coming to the restaurant. I like to see the VIPs. I like to, you know, it's an interesting thing, you know?
Do you do research and development in a centralized location for new projects? Like, do you have a specific time where your corporate chef or your team goes to a restaurant and you're developing things for upcoming projects, or does it work slightly more organically where you just people have ideas and maybe they share them all at different times?
Right. I mean, like I say, every project is different. Like right now we're working on a pizzeria in Miami. Mm-hmm. So we have experience in pizzeria already. So we actually, transforming the recipes a little bit to the Miami style, but we're not changing everything. So we do some development. When it's new, completely new concept, then either we take a team and we go to the restaurant and we do the opening. And I have already an idea about the menu and the presentation and how it's supposed to look on the plate. But development, pure development, we don't have a space where we do only development, no.
So you have all these projects. There's many in the works and more coming. Do you think that is there a specific set goal in mind, or do you just sort of, as projects come, you evaluate whether they're right or not? I guess what I'm asking is, do you ever think there'll be a time when you'll stop opening things and you'll sort of just stay in one restaurant and that'll be your restaurant, or do you enjoy opening things too much to do that?
No, I think there will be this day, yeah. This day exists. I don't know when it is, you know. But it's been my 51st or 52nd restaurant opening. So at some point, you know, enough is enough. But I'm still enjoying it.
And I love that. You know. 52, sooner or later, it'll be enough, isn't it? So in your current format of all these restaurant projects that you're opening, are you the CEO, or do you have a partner who takes on that role?
No, I have nobody. I don't give myself a title, you know.
I just am not sure how you find the time in the day, since you said that you work service at your restaurant, but right. I imagine that you field phone calls and emails from other projects and things of that nature. Have you built a strong infrastructure that allows you to, how do you focus on service when you know that there's 12, 15 other restaurants that are running in various cities around the world? Like, how do you compartmentalize all these projects that you have?
I mean, look, you have to trust people who work for you in each individual restaurant. I'm up early to do email, mm-hmm. you know. So, we have a good team. I have an assistant and a corporate chef, and then we run it this way.
When was the last time you went on a vacation?
Last week.
Where'd you go?
India.
Were you doing research, though, for a restaurant?
No, not at all. No. It was actually my dad's birthday, and I took him for this birthday. I don't see him a lot. He lives in France. So we took him on a journey in India.
Sounds great. Well, I'm glad you got to take a little bit of time for yourself. Yeah. So the restaurant in New York, The Vine and L'Amico, where are those located?
Yeah, L'Amico.
L'Amico.
The friend in Italian.
And where are they located?
Also, they are on 29 and 6th Avenue in the Eventi Hotel. It's a Kimpton property.
And for those looking to find your new project that's opening in Miami, it's in a hotel. Which hotel is it?
It's in the Betsy Hotel, and it's in between Collins and Ocean Drive on 14th Street.
Well, as you heard, everyone, there's quite a few restaurants where you can go to taste his cuisine. Chef, thank you so much for joining us and talking a little bit about your business structure and also your story and how you ended up in New York City. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. for new episodes of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food Radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.